welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. And after that long and cumbersome disclaimer, makes me feel like I should say something bad.
Watch what you say.
It just makes me want to kind of go off the rails or something. I don't know. It's got a provoking sort of quality to it anyway. I missed the short and sweet one. Maybe it's because I didn't listen to that one. Oh, my gosh. So, I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And... Nice. That's real nice.
Bill told me not
Why does she treat me that way? It's horrible.
He told me not to mess up his, not to mess up his ad, so I didn't say anything.
That's what we were doing. Sponsor of this hour is Team Power, our local John Deere Kubota tractor dealer. They're up in Shasta Lake City at 3119 Twinview Boulevard. And anything tractors, they can take care of you up there. They're loaded with inventory right now. Go in there and get a great deal. And service, you can get your tractor worked on, get it tuned up. Take your mower in there and get the blade sharpened because the grass is growing like an inch a minute right now. So
I can hear it. I can hear it from here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had the lawn guy come out Friday, and today it looks like it needs to be mowed again. I mean, it's that time of year. So go out and see him.
Yeah, cut it before it all dies.
Yeah,
before and then you light your neighborhood on fire.
Yeah. Phone number out there is 226-9226, Team Power. Now it's your turn to speak. I will allow it.
There's nothing like just not saying anything and looking at the other person. I used to love doing that to Elizabeth. It's been a long time since I've done that. And I won't do it again right away, otherwise it won't work.
Yeah, I'll give you the look.
Anyway, a lot going on out in the free world. So we have two guests for you today. So you've got two things to choose from. The first hour, we are chatting with Dan Johnson. We have not talked to Dan.
It's been like 3 years or...
December of 2013.
Oh, wow.
I know. I was like, well, we haven't talked to you for a couple of years. And I looked back in the archives. Yeah, December of 2013. So he's 24 now.
Yeah, he was a mere child.
What a difference time makes, huh?
Yeah.
So he has created an organization called We Do Better. And I don't know if then government is actually part of the title, but I put it in parentheses because obviously it makes sense and that's what they're doing. But Dan, who is 24, is the founder of three national nonprofit organizations. At 18, that's when we met him, he founded People Against the NDAA, or PANDA, which became one of the largest civil liberties organizations in America. Passed laws protecting the right to trial by jury in seven cities and countries. After PANDA, he founded the Solutions Institute, the first nonpartisan activist training center in the U.S. And together with his board of over 30 of the top activists in the U.S., he brought local, national, and international media attention to dozens of protests and rallies and helped over 70 organizations enact, defeat, and raise awareness about various public policies in their first year. So I put all the links and things on the website. It's wethepeopleradio.us. And I do hope you'll go there. There's a great video if you want to hear more from Dan. He did a great video with a guy who, Dan, what's the guy's name? The anarchy guy.
Jeff Berwick.
There you go. It doesn't. I'm just looking at the little YouTube clip, and it doesn't say who it is. But that was a great interview. I listened to it yesterday, so I got a little sneak preview on what you've been up to. But we are specifically talking to Dan today because on Tuesday there is something happening in hearing happening in Sacramento. So if you happen to live in California and you happen to be listening on May the 6th, just in case we replay this at a later time.
And you don't like giving money to the government.
Yeah, and you want your money to go someplace that will actually do some good, then you should get a pen and keep listening. All right, Dan, take it away. Tell us what We Do Better means or does. And is then government part of it?
Then government is the implied part of it.
Okay.
That's correct.
I wrote it on there in case people didn't figure that out. Spoiler alert.
Well, the We and We Do Better does stand for We the People. It does not stand for my organization, even though I love the team that we have here. And we do cut out the last part, then government, because, frankly, it's not necessary to to make the statement it's understood by all parties. And our number one target and our number one audience has been progressives and mainstream Democrats. So approaching them in the language they understand and they can work with, it starts with "we do better" and focus on the positive rather than on the negative. But that said, the best way to explain "we do better" is in Hurricane Harvey, that hurricane dropped about 2 trillion gallons of water on the Texas coast. The combined weight of the United States federal government through the Coast Guard, which had over 33 helicopters, many professional rescue teams, and millions and millions and millions of dollars in resources, was deployed to the hurricane about a day or two after it made landfall. And that combined force rescued about 4,500 people, according to their own numbers. And while that is obviously fantastic, and we should praise the Coast Guard for their efforts, a little ragtag group of guys with boats from Louisiana called the Louisiana Cajun Navy. They have walkie-talkies, GPS, and gas money. And they rescued 6,000 people during Hurricane Harvey.
Yeah, that really was an amazing effort. They got a little bit of press on that, but I don't think people really realized the scope of what they accomplished.
I don't think people do. I mean, when I was working with them, we had they had set up an online ticket system. Basically, what you'd do is they had several teams. I was on the social media team, and people would post on Twitter or on Facebook, "Hey, my family's drowning at such and such an address." And we would find them, and we would contact them, get a phone number, figure out where the water level was, and then put it in a ticket system, and then it would let the nearest boat that was to their area know, by the way, these people need to be picked up. And it really was the effort of tons of volunteers. But at the end of the day, the results speak for themselves. And this doesn't just happen. You talk about the media didn't cover it. The media doesn't cover very well at all when the people go out there and deliver public services or address human needs in their communities. You might get a little feel-good story of when, you know, the local scouts plant some trees. But when it comes to actual, you know, public services, another good one, and this is California specific, there is a nonprofit organization in San Diego, California, called Saved in America. It is an organization of former Navy SEALs, law enforcement, and private investigators. Their number one and only goal is to find missing children. Since 2014, they've found over 70 missing children. Their average time to find these children is within 9 days, and they only spend $5,000 to find each child on average. Whereas law enforcement hunts can go on for weeks and months sometimes, never finding the children.
Wow.
These are examples, and I could list off example after example, but long story short is this. The vast majority of human needs in this country are addressed by the people through informal groups, through nonprofits, through for-profits, etc. But the vast majority of resources for public services, i.e. tax dollars, that's going directly to the government. There's a problem with that imbalance, and that is a problem we've chosen to solve.
You know, and it's such a great idea, Dan, because I can't think of too many government agencies that, if privatized, the private sector would do such a better job. And I don't care if you're talking about filling potholes or feeding hungry people.
There's one pothole, like right where we park at church in the road. We're going to just name it because I don't think it's ever going away.
You ever step in that thing, you're going to break a leg. But no, it's true. It's amazing the waste and the bureaucracy that occurs when the government gets involved in anything. And I think you're a shining example of what can be done. We got to take a break and be back, and let's focus.
Let's
on
Let's talk
it.
More with Dan.
Yeah, let's.
Oh my
talk
God,
more
what
with
a great idea!
Hey, why don't we? As long as we got him on the phone.
Dan's our hostage for the next 45 minutes. In case you were wondering, you are listening to We the People. Join us online, WeThePeopleRadio.us.
you're dreaming about California. It don't matter at all where you play.
Me and all my friends, we're all misunderstood. They say we stand for nothing and there's no way we ever could. Now we see everything that's going wrong with the world and those who lead it. Just feel like we don't have the means to rise above and beat it. So we keep waiting, waiting, waiting on the world to change. We keep on waiting, waiting.
We're not going to wait anymore.
But unlike the song, Dan is not waiting.
No.
And it's kind of fun because a lot of people talk about the problem.
Right.
But they don't actually come up with ideas.
So if let's say you owed taxes, you know, just by chance, you owed some money to the government.
State government.
And you had a choice. Let's talk about that. Where could we get that money?
Talk about this charitable credit, Dan.
Well, sure. So first of all, I have to mention that this isn't necessarily my idea. We probably came up with it independently, but somebody beat me to it by about 20 years, which is a good thing.
Is that agent treachery overcomes youth and skill? Is that the deal?
Well, you know, some of the best companies out there just took somebody else's product and made it better. And
of
then
course.
Sold it.
That's true.
So anyway,
can't figure it out.
China's got a whole country operating like that. I digress.
Hey, I will get my my cheap Amazon goods shipped from China any day. So
his name's Dan anyway. Johnson. I'll post his phone number. They're going to come after you on Twitter, Dan. They're going to shame you.
Oh God, I'll be cast to supporting sweatshops within 3 hours.
Exactly.
So, So Arizona in 1997 during the welfare reform push. They were looking at, you know, should we institute work requirements? Should we cut welfare? Should we increase it? How should we reform welfare in this state? And the Beacon Hill Institute published an article about something called a compassion credit. And one of the representatives in Arizona thought that that was a fantastic idea and presented it to the legislature. And eventually, at the end of the year, the governor signed it into law. And what it did is it allowed Arizonans to take up to 200 of their state income tax dollars and direct it to any nonprofit organization that served the poor in Arizona. And only about 3,000 or so taxpayers took advantage of it in the first year. It wasn't very well publicized. It had several requirements, such as you had to take the credit and tell the government you were taking it by December instead of April. So anybody who files their taxes like a normal person didn't know about it till next year, and they immediately forgot about it afterward. Well, fast forward to 2016. 130,000 taxpayers took this credit, and they sent $52 million to over 800 nonprofit organizations in
wow.
the state of Arizona. And that credit worked so well that a bipartisan bill with both Republicans and Democrats passed at the end of 2016, doubling the credit from $200 per person to $400 per person, and we haven't even seen the numbers on that yet.
Hmm. Yeah, because you have to assume that anybody that contributed to 200 under the new plan would double it. You know, why not?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what are the restrictions on the organizations that can participate in that, or are there?
So in Arizona, the restrictions are the nonprofit has to spend at least half its revenue serving people who are 150% or less above the poverty line. We think that that's a restriction that was put there for political purposes because there's really no point at which someone, you know, they don't cross from 150 to 151
right.
and then go, all of a sudden, we're rich and now we can give away all of our money.
Yeah, or all of a sudden they're poor.
Or all of a sudden they're poor, right? Cross from 151 to 150. That restriction isn't necessarily something we support in our legislation in California. In our draft legislation, the universal charitable credit does not have that restriction. But even with that restriction, you have over 800 organizations, and you have, you know, $52 million going to them in just 1 year.
So people have lots of choices. It isn't just the, you know, faux government NGO guys that are swooping in and grabbing up all the money.
Well, and what's interesting is at first, the United Way, some bigger organizations that don't have the most efficiency and probably in many cases aren't the best charities to give to, at first they got most of the credit because they were the ones with the advertising budget. They're the ones going out and saying, hey, you should do this, et cetera. But as we got closer and closer to 2016, United Way fell from first to fourth to, I think, they're like seventh in the nonprofits people are donating to, because the more people realize this choice actually exists, and the more people that take that choice, the numbers show they're directing the money toward the best, the most efficient, the nonprofits that are actually making a difference in their community.
So is there how do they find the groups that are qualified?
Do they
have a list they can choose from, or do they have to go out and research that part themselves?
The Arizona Department of Revenue is required to every year update the list on their website. That is a list of nonprofits people can choose from.
Oh, nice. So you were thinking, why did you, besides the fact that we have a huge number of people living under the poverty line in California, but why did you guys choose to focus on California next?
Well, California was the state that embraced it the most, actually.
Really?
So basically, what we've done, what I've done in my past organizations, and what we really, really do with this one, at the end of the day, this is about empowering the people to do better. And it's up to the people of the state. We write the legislation. We say, hey, here's a suggestion. And then we let people in that state go, yeah, this is important enough. We want to contact our representatives and go do it. And this bill in California is no different. The Federation of California Republican Women got behind this, as well as several nonprofits and a couple Democratic voting groups. And they pressured Senator Mike Morrell into actually introducing it. He'd introduced a modified version of it in 2014, but we kind of put some pressure on him to introduce it this year, and he did. And we're looking at flooding the committee room of the Senate Governance and Finance Committee on May 9th at 10 a.m. I'll actually be flying out from Georgia to speak in favor of the bill, and we'll probably have several nonprofits there. We'll have probably a decent crowd, and anyone, of course, listening to the radio is welcome to join us. But the key here, I don't know if we'll be able to get it through committee and onto the floor this year in California, but we're going to pop enough signal flares that the politicians don't have the moral ground anymore. And when they lose the moral high ground, in a lot of ways, they're going to lose a lot of the progressive left. And that's what we found, and that's what our strategy is in California.
And so that would, if that did get to the floor, that would put it up for a vote on election date? I mean, is that something we have to vote on, or?
This is not a ballot initiative.
This is a bill.
This is a piece of legislation.
It's actually SB 1485 is the legislation, the California number. And what committee, again, Dan? I'm going to post that.
It's the State Senate Governance and Finance Committee, Room 112.
Okay. All right. I'm going to put that in here so that people can check. And that's May 9th around 10 a.m. You think about 10 a.m.?
Yeah, about 10 a.m. Obviously, they're government, so they could hold the hearing sometime between 10 and 2 o'clock in the morning. But we're looking at about 10 a.m.
Cool. I think that's awesome. And your biggest obstacle on this thus far, you had said, was one of the guys over on the coast.
Absolutely. State Senator Mike McGuire.
So he's Del Norte, Humboldt, Trinity, Mendocino, and Sonoma counties we looked at the other day, just for reference.
And what's his complaint about the bill?
Well, he has a couple complaints. Number one is, and probably the most important, it's the only complaint really that matters because he started a couple other ones to look good to the public. He wants to actually limit the bill to people who make $40,000 a year or less, who can take the credit, and he wants to put a, it's not even going to be a credit anymore under his plan. It would be a 20% deduction, essentially, which is, I mean, it's a poison pill amendment. He wants nothing more than to kill the bill.
Right.
But the big reason he wants to kill the bill is because although this credit ramps up slowly, as we've seen in Arizona, people pick it up and they move the services over carefully and consistently. It's not a big shift all at once, and that helps the people who are reliant on some of these government services, allows them to switch over to the nonprofits. But at its outset, if it were to have the same impact as Arizona, this would taxpayers would probably direct about $312 million. To organizations in California. And the Senate chair is really concerned about that, not because, of course, that the government does a better job or that government provides all of these great services.
Or that it won't help people.
Or that it won't help people. No, none of that. It's not about the women and children. His number one concern is he will not have control of the purse strings and where the revenue goes.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, why would you limit this to people that make $40,000 or less? I mean, obviously, people that make more money have more money to donate or be charitable with. Why wouldn't you just open it up for anybody that wants to do it?
Well, he's desperately trying to reclaim the moral high ground that he's lost by opposing this bill.
Well, it's just
at the end of the day, that's what it is.
It's just politics.
I mean, if politics worked for the good of the people, I'd have a job in the marketing industry or something.
Sure.
I don't
there
know.
You go.
Well, it sounds like this could be a poison pill for his career.
Well, and we have to take a break. And just for some reason, last night at 11 o'clock, apparently I had a clairvoyant moment because I think that the song we're going to play next actually answers the question. So, in 30 seconds or less, we'll give you the answer here, and we'll be right back with our guest Dan Johnson.
Clenched in fists of rage, no angel born in hell could break that Satan's spell. And as the flames climb high, and...
All right, so we've determined it's about the money.
Oh, it's, I knew
and,
that.
And
would
you know
be...
the other part of it that we were talking about without you, Dan. I'm sorry, we left you unceremoniously on hold. But the other thing is too, you don't need bureaucrats to administer that if the money's going to a charity.
Yeah, and that's their big rub.
So, cuts back on how many government employees we need.
Well, it's not like we're in need of bureaucrats to do regulation either. You have
no, we have plenty. We're good. Yeah, this is
well,
yes, this is California.
You're also in California.
We're pretty much covered.
You have three regulations for every one that you need.
Seven people looking over your shoulder to make sure you complied. You know, it's interesting, though. This happens in – I mean, obviously it happens a lot. But the other example I can think of at the federal level is the CHOICE program for veterans benefits, the health benefits. So there's a – we put a program in, I don't know, three, 4 years ago now called Veterans Choice – which was originally literally a choice. Here is your card, Mr. or Mrs. Veteran. If you don't want to go to the VA, you can go to a private doctor. Then, of course, that was trimmed down, had a bunch of requirements and limits. But the VFW, American Legion, all these veterans organizations oppose the funding. It's coming again. It'll be up in the next, I think it runs out of funding in August or something, so the fight's coming. And the veterans organizations at the national level fight against choice, even though it benefits veterans all over the place, because if they can't get in to their local VA or they live really far away, it allows them to see a local provider. But they feel that it's a move toward privatizing the VA. And this is the very same thing. It's a move toward privatizing services to the public.
Well,
and why is that scary? I don't understand why that's so frightening.
I'll only disagree with that slightly, in that if We Do Better's bill passes in California tomorrow and not a single taxpayer takes advantage of it, nothing changes.
Correct.
All we're doing, we're not going to go in and force privatize anything. And I don't particularly like the word privatization for 15 million reasons, but I'll get to those eventually. What we're doing is we're saying, look, the people of California are only allowed to choose one method to take care of public services with their tax dollars.
Right.
That's it. One method. And it should be up to the people of the community. It should be up to the people of the state. It should be up to the individual where you want those dollars to go. And if everybody says, look, the government of California is the most efficient, least abusive, best operating machine in existence, and I want my tax dollars to go to them, go ahead. That's fine. That probably won't be the answer.
It's more like I'm too lazy to look up a charity to donate to, actually.
or you're too. And of course, there are solutions for that, too. You know, just a couple of years ago, in Flagstaff, Arizona, a group of charities, and the charities in Flagstaff, realized that this could be a huge boon for them, that they could get a lot of resources this way. And so they formed the Flagstaff Tax Credit Coalition. And then they realized that one of the advantages government had was it was a centralized place. You pay them, you write them one check, and then they distribute it out to whatever services, and you've done your civic duty, and you can go do whatever. So they created a portal where, imagine doing your taxes like this. You go to the portal, you click on donate. You type in your name and information, and then you check a box for each of the charities that you want your $400 to go to, and you hit submit. It takes 2 minutes. And they were able to raise, through the credit, about $1 million within
awesome.
By their fourth year. So.
See, and the other thing, too, with this idea, you know, people like ownership. You know, not necessarily physically owning, but I mean, they like to take ownership of their money, of their projects. And so this would obviously make people look at their community a little more, look at what services were available, and probably follow the charities that they donate, to through this program. I would imagine they keep better track of them, and they probably donate more money outside of that. I mean, I think actually they would all, that there would be more money coming in to help people than they have just by, you know, the confiscatory tax policy that we have in place.
Well, if you think about it, we have a place on our website, wedobetter.org, where we list the 8 fundamental flaws of government provision of public services. Basically, every time you ask the government to provide a service, it doesn't matter whether you want them provided or not. It could be the military. It could be planting trees in your backyard. If you ask the government to provide a service, these are the flaws that will come with it, just so you know. And one of those key flaws is it makes someone less likely to act on their compassion. So we came up with this brilliant system by which we take a bunch of people who have money to give, and then we make a bunch of people who need that money angry at those people, And then we pass laws making those people who have money give their money and have no control over it to the people who need it. And then the people who need it are like, well, this is abusive, and so we pass regulations to protect them. And the people who are giving it go, well, these guys are buying salmon at the grocery store, and so we pass regulations back and forth. You want to know how red tape gets created?
Mm-hmm.
It gets created in that tug of war between the very group of groups of people who need to be associating the absolute most. And taxation, the way we currently do taxes, is this system where, yes, it was a decent idea to begin with, and yes, I'm actually saying this on the radio, because taxes was invented by the ancient Sumerians for war. Basically, we're being attacked, and if people don't throw a few dollars in the pot, we're all going to die. At the time, probably made sense. But where we are today, with the organizations, with the associations, with what we have in society today, that system is perhaps the most important, the biggest system holding people down, holding their social mobility down, and pitting groups of people in society against each other who, frankly, need to be working together if we're going to address these problems and move forward as a nation.
Yeah, I would totally agree.
Well, I agree 100% with that. But I also think that our government has become so bloated that when you do pay your taxes and they do have a department of whatever to help a specific group of people, how much of that tax dollar goes towards administrating the department and how much of it actually goes towards actually helping the people it was meant to help?
Even if you made that incredibly efficient, so let's say you minimized that, right? And so your delivery was just amazing. The biggest difficulty, I think, the one I see the most, is that people are limited to a certain amount of money. And
right.
And so you're looking at like $800 to $900 a month, and if they make over that, then they lose. I mean, if they get a part-time job or whatever, then the government subsidy goes down, so they're trapped in this cycle of poverty that they can never get out of. It actually incentivizes, you know, what we used to joke about with the school thing, you know, the race to the bottom. And we have a lot of people trapped in that system, a ton.
Speaking of school, I have my hand up in the back. Ooh, pick me.
Dan, do you have something to add?
I might. So the Urban Institute, to the first point, the Urban Institute, which is not exactly a conservative think tank, the Urban Institute did a study about where the state TANF, temporary assistance for needy families, block grants are going. Where does the tax dollars that someone pays for basic cash assistance, where does that money go? How much can it really cost to pay a guy to sit in an air-conditioned room and write checks to people all day? Well, for every $10 that someone pays into the TANF system, on average, $2.46 actually ends up in the hands of the welfare recipient. It's a 75% overhead. And on average, we find that about 50 of that a federal agency, if they're operating really efficiently, spends about 50% of its revenue on administrative staff, salaries, benefits, etc., whereas a nonprofit on average spends about 30%, still less efficient than the private sector, but you're getting just about two times your bang for the buck. And a direct comparison is Crossroads, Michigan. Crossroads of Michigan actually has a welfare program. They have a basic cash assistance program, very similar to the federal government's program. But because they're actually about giving the cash to people and not about giving the cash to an employee to give the cash to people, their efficiency rate runs at about 90%. So $9 of every 10
And is that a program by the state of Michigan, or is it a private?
That is a private 501c3 privately funded nonprofit program.
I was like, it had the word Michigan in it, so it's either about the state or by the state.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course,
about the state would be the 90%.
The problem there is you don't have any control, or maybe it's not a problem. There's no control over how they spend that money. They can go out and buy cigarettes. They can buy booze. They can buy drugs. They can buy, if you're just giving them cash.
How does it work? What do they find over there?
So the nice thing, first of all, it's an integrated program. So they do give them the cash assistance, and they sometimes give them transportation assistance, like bus assistance and stuff like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all directed at getting them a job in the workforce.
Ah.
And the nice thing about a nonprofit, I'm not advocating that a nonprofit set up a national program and everybody jump on that program either. Nice thing about a nonprofit is their financial incentive is not to have people on that program, but their mission is to help them. So their goal is to get them off the program, have them temporary on the program for as long as they can, and then have them off the program into a job and back into the workforce. And they can do things like, guy comes in and goes, hey, I got a job. It makes just as much as you guys are giving me. But if you guys take away what you're giving me right now, like the federal government does automatically,
right?
If you guys take away what you're giving me right now, then all I'm relying on is this job, and if they, you know, decide to get rid of me or lay off or whatever, then I'm back to square one. Can I get half of it still? And the nonprofit can go, absolutely, yeah, you can. Whereas the federal government, there's just this automatic, if there's many jobs that people who are of lower income, who are in poverty, want to take. But if they take it, it'll cut their benefits down so much they can't do that to their family.
Yep.
And the flexibility of nonprofits, even for-profits, things like that, the flexibility of this world allows you to treat every individual as an individual instead of a minority and, you know, tough luck.
Well, and since it isn't administered at a national level, you can actually tailor things for community because the people in the community are working with other people in their community. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. Gee whiz, it's like the olden days, Dan. You've somehow stumbled on something from the olden days that used to actually work. Oh, my gosh. We have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back. Our guest is Dan Johnson. He is working on a project called the Charitable Credit. You can find it on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. Dan started the fire.
Yeah, he did. He lit it.
Oh, Dan, you little problem child.
So, Dan, I don't know. Maybe I missed that part, but SB 1485, what the way it's written right now, what is going to be the amount that people can donate?
Redirect.
Or redirect.
It would be $500, which is about the what the average, a quarter of what the average Californian pays in income tax.
Okay.
Okay, that's pretty good.
And are there a lot of other states doing this now other than Arizona?
So We Do Better is active in 12 states right now. Actually, these states, the campaign from the beginning is, look, when it comes to the economic side of things, the right is, the people who lean right, generally fairly easy to get on board with, except the Republicans in Congress, but they're a whole different story.
That is another set of problems, all just fraught with difficulty.
But when it comes to the left, they generally, you have to prove that you care first before they're even willing to listen to any of that. And so our strategy from the beginning has been to go to the progressives. We launched at Netroots Nation, which is the largest, it's basically the progressive CPAC. It's the largest progressive conference in the country. We launched there last year. And we've gotten tremendous support from them. And so our top three states that we're active in are actually California, Illinois, and New York.
That's confusing.
And we're also active in Georgia. We're active in Florida. We may have a bill dropping in Puerto Rico sometime soon because of the disaster relief work we did there. All of these opportunities are coming up. But at the end of the day, you know, we're just, I guess you could say, a catalyst. You know, we're saying, here's an idea, here's a concept, and here are the tools to implement this in your state. Here are the tools to say, you know what, if you're in California, to say, I'm going to call State Senator McGuire, and I'm going to call State Senator McGuire at 916-651-4002, and I'm going to say, hey, this is the type of legislation that represents the people of California. This is the type of legislation we need in California. Again, that number. Remember, I've been in politics a little while. That number, 916-651-4002, call Senator McGuire and say, you need to support this because the people of California support it.
And this is Senate Bill 1485. So it's the Universal Charitable Credit.
The California Universal Charitable Credit, absolutely, SB 1485, and obviously, and they can go to your website and get the information about the meeting in Sacramento on May 9th, I assume.
Yes.
It's refreshing to know that it's a bipartisan, the bipartisan response is good.
I mean, for the most part, except for what's-his-face on the coast, but the coast never seems to be, it's like a coastal problem. So look at what your, if you live in the state of California, check with your state senator and find out if they support this or not. Because, honestly, if you're not one of their constituents, they don't care what you think. So, make sure you call whoever it is that represents you. But if you know people who live in an area like the northern coastal counties, who else is big opposition? I was thinking, people have relatives and friends all over the place.
Big opposition is, as usual, going to be party leadership. They tend to be, they're the people who killed this in Idaho. This year. They're the people who are going. I mean, you're going to contrast this to what the party leadership in California presented. I don't remember the bill number, but about a month and a half ago or so, there was a bill introduced by Kevin De Leon. And it was the California Excellence Fund bill. I'm not sure how familiar you were if you pay attention to that. But the idea was, because Trump passed this Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, that people wouldn't be able to take the SALT deduction, the state and local tax deduction, over $10,000. They would be able to give the rest of that money to this California Excellence Fund and get a tax credit, very similar to our bill, except for limited to one charity, this brand-new California Excellence Fund. And they would get a deduction, and they'd be in the same place, essentially, as if they were taking the SALT deduction before. The fun little key about this California Excellence Fund is it is literally the definition of a fake charity.
I was going to say, who is the charity?
Yeah. Uh-oh, fake charity already?
It is a brand-new charity created by the legislature of California.
Oh, well, there you go.
Appropriated by the legislature of California. Mm. Regulated and controlled by the legislature of California.
Wow.
It is basically a renaming of the general fund to a charity.
Yeah.
It's like they installed a giant parking meter in your wallet. That's fantastic. You must be the meter.
I mean, at the end of the day, this is what the establishment politicians in California have presented. They've said that what we want to do is create fake charities that don't do any more good for the people and make us look good and make us have the revenue. What we're saying is there are real charities, like Saved in America, that are doing real work in
the
cities
and
counties, that have a track record in the state of California, and that you should be able to send your money to. And if you're outside the state of California, if you go to WeDoBetter.org and you say, hey, I want to lead an effort in my county for property taxes. I want to lead an effort in my city, in my state. I want to say, hey, the people should be empowered to do what they do best in my state. You go to WeDoBetter.org. We've got a crack team. We write the legislation. We've been involved in grassroots action. We know how to do this, and we're happy to train you. But at the end of the day, where this goes, who has a charitable credit in their state, is going to be completely up to the people and the organizations in that state to say, we do better, We know we do better. Not one day, not we can, not someday the free market will take over and we'll all sing kumbaya.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, today, with a track record, there are organizations, we'd like to support them, and frankly, we'd like to be able to direct our dollars away from abusive government agencies or agencies that aren't doing their best job. We'd like an accountability mechanism that exists directly in this charitable credit. And we'd like that in our state. You can go to wedobetter.org and sign up for your state there. I know I'm running out of time, but immediately after I testify, thankfully we were able to raise all of the money necessary. Thanks to the great people of California, we were able to raise all the money necessary to get me out there as an expert witness and to help rally people to the committee meeting. We're going to attempt to raise money now. I'm heading to the Liberators Conference in Northeast Ohio to speak to about 300 people, including Tea Party leaders and Republican legislators. And we need to raise about $400 for that. So if that's your cup of tea, if that's how you'd like to support the movement, you can go to wedobetter.org, click on donate, and do that. But at the end of the day, if there's one thing you take away from this broadcast, besides be there in California, it's not we can, not eventually, not when the politicians give us permission, but right now, today, we do better, and we should be able to take our resources and go do even better.
Exactly.
Hear, hear. See, and it can be done with, I mean, you're working with, what, 30 different people, you said?
Okay. Yeah, about 30 different organizations in Cali right now.
That's fantastic. And I don't know, you know, people say that people in their 20s are worthless. Now, of course, we all meet those people, but hey, I meet people in their 50s that are worthless too, so go figure. But at 24, you're a very nice example of what can be done when people put their mind to it. Dan?
Well, I guess that's a compliment, isn't it?
Well, we definitely appreciate your work on this and bringing this to light. And I just hope everybody gets on board with this SB 1485. At least get on there and take a look at it and see what it's about.
Yeah,
and put some pressure on your representatives to get this thing moving.
And I know a lot of people are Facebookers and Twitter users and stuff, and if you go to wethepeopleradio.us, all that is there, and it's linked, and you can just fire it off to friends, and the commercial-free archive of this will be up just a little bit later this afternoon. Thanks a million, Dan. We hope to chat with you more recently than, you know, this five-year gap, kind of weird. Shoot, if we do that again, you'll be like 30 years old. You'll be like an old man.
Well, thank you guys very much for having me on, and hopefully I can come back on and say we got it through committee and let's beat up some different politicians.
Please do.
There you
know
go.
What? Let us know.
All right. Awesome. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
As our guest, Dan Johnson. We're coming back with Soraya Dean on a whole new topic. See you later. WeThePeopleRadio.us. Welcome to the second hour of We the People. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And Bill has our sponsor information. I didn't think I was going to get away with it 2 hours in a row, but I almost got him again.
Okay, let's try that again.
Yeah, this is the part where I just look at you.
Yeah, you say, I'm Aaron Ryan.
I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Team Power.
It's like we planned it.
Yeah, yeah. They're our local John Deere and Kubota tractor dealer. And I'll tell you what, they do a fantastic job up there. If you guys need a tractor for either small jobs, big jobs, if you got 2 acres or 200 acres, they've got a tractor up there for you. Go see them at 3119 Twin View Boulevard. They're running some pretty good service times right now. If you got something that needs repaired, give them a call. Get it in there and get it worked on. They also have field mechanics who can go out and do the repairs right at your site.
So give them a call at 226-9226, Team Power. And that's my bit right there. Is that okay,
Aaron? I didn't interrupt too much, did I, Bill?
No, Aaron, you did fine.
Gosh, this is just like home.
Yeah, it is.
Just like home. It's really funny. Just like home with a lot of extra people. Oh, man. Well, our guest this hour, this is going to be a whole different thing. Switching gears from the state legislature and charitable trusts and all that stuff. We have Soraya Dean with us. Easy for me to say. She is a Clarion Project Advisory Board member and a founder of the Muslim Women's Speakers Movement and basically an international activist. She has, I wouldn't even begin to read this bio because it's really, really long, but incredibly interesting. Her website is sorayadeen.com, SORAYADEEN.com. And she's got some great resources on there. She's involved in a little bit of everything. But she's a spiritual activist, a lawyer, a certified nonviolent parent educator, and the author of Peace Matters, Raising Peace-Conscious Children. And her vision is to create 10,000 voices of hope. So that's all kind of nice, empowering them to resolve conflict, be effective communicators, all those things that we seem to be steering away from these days.
Yeah, we don't seem to teach a lot of that in school anymore.
And we've linked her article, which is kind of what brought her to us, Only Free Speech Can Stop Radical Islam. So that's a message that obviously needs to get out, so we're thrilled to give her a platform. So, Soraya, take it away.
Thank you, Erin. I am so, and Bill, I'm so feeling so great and grateful to be on your show this afternoon.
No, we're glad to have you.
Thank you.
So I like the idea of speaking up, getting rid of the political correctness, getting out of the 7th century, and moving forward. I mean, your message, and I did some reading on your site, and obviously you take, you take some hits with all of this, but I don't see any other way we fix this problem.
Absolutely, Erin. You know, this dawned on me because, you know, after 9/11, my son was accused of being a terrorist, and that really hit me home. And then I began my journey into activism, and I traveled far and wide representing the Muslim community. In fact, early last year, I was in Oregon. I traveled 1,000 miles and met 1,000 people who didn't know a Muslim. I went into school. So I put a face to the fear and uncertainty and not knowing Muslims. And when I come back home, I find it way more challenging than when I'm out of it. There's so much patriarchy and there's so much resistance to deconstruct our received theology that we are all sucked into this cycle of violence that is happening in the name of Islam and Muslims internationally.
Yeah,
and there I began to ask these tough questions, and I felt, and I still strongly, you know, and we need to put our house in order. So that's when I started speaking up, and as you quite rightly said, it's been a very challenging journey.
Yeah, because I would imagine in a lot of circles, Muslim circles, you're probably incredibly unpopular.
Very. I mean, they call me an Islamophobe, failing to realize, you know, there's a difference, there's a line between questioning your faith and fearing it, you know. I don't fear it. I feel we need to deconstruct some of the received theology, and I address that because we have gender inequality, patriarchy, misogyny, and blasphemy laws internationally that are enforced. So we need to speak into those challenging passages.
Well, and it's interesting because they've conveniently made rules that you can't question anything, which obviously doesn't really lead to a very open dialogue. But
yeah, and how do you go back? I mean, you've really got a challenge ahead of you. You go in and rewrite a lot of the stuff that's written, like you say, in the 7th century.
And hey,
to
why
make
not just
modern.
Be a woman while you're at it? I mean,
yeah,
because women are so powerful.
I know, double whammy, yeah.
Yeah, in that culture, I mean, they're running everything anyway, right?
Yes.
And you come from Sri Lanka. And how long has it been, I mean, like, how long have you been here? And give us some perspective on that. I'm just curious.
Yeah, so Sri Lanka is a little island below India.
Right.
And again, you know, 15% of Muslims live in the Middle East, but they drive the conversation. Most of the Muslims live in South, in Asia. So I've been living in the United States for the last 20 years.
So you've got
a
pretty good
balance. I was in Sri Lanka just 5 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I was shaken to see the amount of Arabization that's happening even in little countries. The Saudis have very masterfully spread their tentacles, doling out their money and doing a lot of damage to a lot of people, particularly the Muslims.
Interesting. And I don't see... I mean, okay, you know, anybody who knows me knows I'm not much of a feminist. I mean, Bill doesn't get to boss me around or anything, but, you know,
sure.
A lot of this stuff that passes for feminism these days, I think actually just takes away our rights. But in that culture, you're not encouraged to be outspoken, I guess, or to question and all of those things. So how do you get people to step up at that level?
Well, to clarify your question, within the United States, we have 3.45 Americans who are Muslims. And we are the most culturally and religiously diverse community in the United States. So a lot of us bring our culture.
Mm.
But here in the United States, we are a melting pot.
Right.
And with the fundamental rights that we have in term, from the Constitution, freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom of movement. Freedom, really, we believe in the United States, is the power to question anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I believe, is the basis of human progress. So it is not as challenging for us who women who are here in the United States. But when you look at other countries, that is why this work is so important, because I don't think women will get the opportunity to raise these issues anywhere else as they would in the United States. And my call to my community is, don't get offended. Let's raise these questions. Let's be glad people are asking these questions so that people everywhere is going to benefit.
It's interesting you had said that your son was looked at as being a terrorist. And prior to that, you just didn't, did you, there were just no problems particularly? I mean, why was that such a, I mean, obviously that would be a huge wake-up call, but was that really different for you?
Yeah, absolutely, Erin. I mean, it really shook my very being, because I was at school to pick him up that day.
Mm-hmm.
It was September 11th, 2007, and he was 7 years old, and he was sobbing, and it really
shook me. Oh, he was a little
me.
Kid. Okay.
Yeah. He was a little kid, yes. And then he was telling me about how the teacher had probed further. And, Mom, I was so scared, I put my head down and I didn't even say I was a Muslim. And then I thought, you know, we need to speak up, because they're born here. And this is, for me, even for me, home is not where my grandparents are buried anymore. It's here. So I thought it is very important, and it became very timely for me to show up as an American who is a Muslim and who loves this country and who's here to do my above and beyond my best. And then in that journey, I realized there's some things that I had to put right within. And so that's why I speak to the theology that needs to be reinterpreted. And I call on the community to be better and more vigorous and committed grassroots activists, because people don't know us. A Pew poll said about 60% of Americans don't know a Muslim. So there's a lot of...
So you can kind of make up whatever you want at that point, huh?
Yes, and then it depends on which news and media you listen to, and there's fear bills, and then, you know, you don't know somebody, and then it's a huge cycle. And to be able to interrupt that is something I take very as a privilege and as a duty.
We have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm curious how you became connected with the Clarion Project. We've had Raheel Raza on several times prior, and it's funny, you have the same message, and I'm always curious how you find each other, because the Clarion Project is really, I think, making a big difference. Our guest today is Soraya Dean. She's an international activist, founder of the Muslim Women Speakers Movement, and a Clarion Project Advisory Board member. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People.
And out of
And on that happy note. All right, Soraya, how did you find the Clarion Project, or did they find you?
I think both happened at the same time. It's like a marriage made in heaven. All the reformers gather and gravitate towards the Clarion Project because, it gives us a voice. Because within the community, there's this mindset that we don't need to reform Islam. We don't need to reform the Muslims. Everything is perfect. And the Clarion Project has consistently and quite well and accurately addressed this concept of political Islam, radical Islam, extremism, and Islamism, when nobody else has. It is a non-profit founded in 2006. And for me, I'm extremely grateful to be knowing them and associated with them and being on the advisory council because they give me a platform. They give a platform to every moderate Muslim. We do tremendous outreach to moderate, reform Muslims who would like to join the Clarion Project and work with them. Because what is at the heart of their work, which I so deeply appreciate, is human rights and supporting activists who work for human rights.
See, and that makes the most sense because, the top of their header there, Clarion Project, challenging radical Islam, promoting human rights. And for the last, in the last administration, during the Obama years, there was some unwritten rule that you weren't allowed to call it radical Islam.
Yes.
And so that doesn't help at all, obviously, just pretending that that's not even a problem.
Absolutely, yes. We fail to call it by its name, and therefore we perpetuated the status quo. And I'm so glad with the current administration we are calling it out. But I'm also disappointed that we are not that we are not at the table, Erin. We need to sit at the table. We reformers have to be given not just a seat, but a very prominent one. Because if this thing has to be got done, it can be done only within the United States.
Right, because you, theoretically you're not censored here. But in your article,
yes.
For the people who haven't read it, maybe you could tell them a little bit about the article that you wrote and that will spur them on to
yes.
read it.
So it all began with me, you know. I was a fellow. Every year, 25 Muslims are selected to go to to Israel-Palestine Muslim Leadership Initiative. What they did was when they knew that I was working with Clarion, I mean, they knew that I was raising these cogent, pertinent issues, they rescinded my fellowship. They said you couldn't do. Yeah, they said you can't be a Muslim and do that. It doesn't reflect well on the Muslim.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so
that's helpful.
So that's awful, yeah. So then there was, this is liberty, you know, that people feel you can only say what we authorize or we permit you to say. And it was repugnant to me. And I gladly said, fine, you can have this fellowship. And this really propelled me to speak louder. And I shared this problem, a challenge, really, with Clarion. And I'm here because of the outreach that I do with them. So I get lots of emails in private. People tell me, please make your voice known. Nobody's talking. So that ignites me. So then that was one of the reasons that I wrote that article. And then my colleague and friend, Dr. Jasser, he reads Arabic. He's one of the pioneer reformers. He gets called an Islamophobe and a bigot.
And he's Muslim.
He's Muslim,
right.
And he—I know. So these are the challenges we navigate on a daily basis. You know? So my hope is that sometimes it's not within the community from outside of it when sufficient people support us, hold us, and give us that power and that leap to the next level, the community might wake up.
Well, I thought it was interesting because the title of his talk that he was going to give there at Duke was The American Muslim Identity, Patriot or Insurgent. Well, okay, where I come from, if you want people to show up to something, you give it a good name. You know, I mean,
yeah.
And that would get people, you know, off the couch and in a chair to go listen. But it said, your article said here, they made him change it to the American Muslim Identity.
Yeah, that's a,
boring.
Have you found that the Muslim community as a whole is starting to swing around a little bit, or is it
in the U.S. or everywhere?
In the U.S. I'm sorry. Yeah, in the U.S. Is it are they starting to kind of change a little bit, or is this like just groundbreaking?
No. I think they're still strolling. We need to sprint. They're still strolling. They're still defending, not defining themselves.
Right.
So this is very, very slow. In fact, when I was last year, Bill and Erin, in Berkeley, we opened the first mixed gender mosque for women and men. And I'm a South Asian. I don't wear the hijab. I don't speak Arabic, but I was invited to lead the prayer. And I always say to women, you know, I was the most prepared but the least qualified.
But that was a big step. That was a big step, wasn't it?
Yeah.
For them, yeah.
And so then I took that opportunity. We spoke. We opened the mosque. To this date, we have Friday prayers. Not one major Muslim organization has endorsed that move or support us.
Mm.
Tudor's next is the most liberal Islamic college called the Zaytuna College. Their students even don't even step into this female mosque, to the women's mosque.
We're kind of mosque stupid here.
I didn't realize that mosques were men only.
How does it work in real life? I mean, how do they think it works? Like, what are the rules currently?
Oh, so the mosque, the imams, the person who leads the prayer is, of course, a man.
Okay.
There's a lot of patriarchy. Women are not given the podium to lead a prayer, but after events, like in the evenings, if there's something, they give her the mic. And that's not good enough. Yeah, in gender equality.
Do they get to go in? Does everybody get to go in, or do they have to sit in a special place? Or
We are opening up. Originally, we had to go into the basement or somewhere without fans, and it was very bad. But now, women are given a good prayer space, but we are not given a good leadership role.
Mm.
In the past, a mosque is primarily for the men only?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't
and
know that.
In many places around the world, only men go to the mosque still.
Oh, and women can't even go in the basement? They just don't go at all?
Women are not encouraged and not permitted, except on special, like a festival, like a Ramadan prayer, they might go.
AKA bring your wife to the mosque day?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good way to start.
It's like bringing your kids to work.
Yeah. You know? Okay, yeah.
Oh, man. Well,
so there's segregation in the mosques. But what we are asking for is, the outcomes might be different, but we're asking for equal opportunity to lead the prayer.
Imagine that.
I don't see anything. Yes.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like, to Americans, it doesn't seem like a big thing, but it's amazing that even in this country, they still keep a really rigid hold on how things are done. Do women make it? Women don't get to do anything in the Middle East, do they?
It's still only
men.
Yeah, mostly men. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, Saudi Arabia, they're just telling women can go to a stadium, they can drive.
Right.
In Iran, we know, we're just getting to know millions of women forced to cover their head on a daily basis. That's the law. And these are scary precedents. But again, in countries like Morocco and in Malaysia, lots of things, the reform movements are taking strong shape. Like in India, the Muslim women, they went to the Supreme Court and annulled some practices that were very medieval and very cultural.
Hmm.
So a lot of things are getting stirred up, but for me, it's very slow, though.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. Well, and if you have daughters, I mean, people that are raising girls in this time, are the, I would imagine the kids are pretty probably pretty big fans of the Reform, especially girls.
Yes, absolutely, they are. Now, my daughter asked such clarifying questions, which I never asked. So, yeah, they support Reform. They are more integrated. And that's a challenge for us, too. We are all first-generation immigrants, most of us. But the second generation, and I read another Pew poll that said the second generation of American Muslims are really writing their own stories. And I'm really heartened to know that. Because with my daughter, her best friend is Christian, and I send her to the church on Wednesdays to join the youth group. Because for me, it's all about knowledge and getting to know another faith. Because the way we were raised in my part of the world was, you know, get to know the other. I mean, all my father would say, all rivers flow to the same sea. So I believe what we teach at home is very critical. We can teach to love or we can teach to hate.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like your father kind of had it figured out early.
Well, that's a great way to, it's a great way to make kids culturally aware. I mean, I grew up in a place where, you know, half of our population there was Jewish. And so you were either Catholic or Jewish. And so the Jewish kids went with us to things and we went to things with them and they had different food and different holidays. And I don't know, we were kids. We liked it. It was fun. You don't really think about it like this big, it's not this burden of theology and all that. I mean, you're just kids. It's a great way to help them understand. We're going to come right back with our guest, Soraya Dean. We've got to take a really quick break. You can find everything about the program at wethepeopleradio.us. Back with our guest Soraya Dean. I like your quote. I don't know where I found it, but I pulled it and put it on the webpage. There are two ways to tell your story: stand up and tell it, or wait for someone else to do it.
I thought
that's a really good quote, and it's very good for what you're working on. You've been involved in this Reform movement for how long?
About a couple of years now.
Okay. And are you finding that that people you meet along the way, let's just stick with women that you meet along the way, are they sort of, you know, kind of excited, want to jump in? Do they get pressure at home? I mean, is this one of those things where you have to, you know, sneak out and talk to your friend Soraya?
Yeah, I would imagine there are a lot of them are afraid.
Are you people's secret friend, or, are you the problem person?
All of the above.
Yeah, I would imagine.
All of the above. Yeah, because I mean, I have to watch my words. It's. I mean, you know, as a speaker, my mentor, Les Brown, always taught me, it's not what you have to say, but what they need to listen. And whenever we broach this topic of Reform, there is so much resistance therein. So I have to always approach this topic very gingerly. And oftentimes we don't agree because people feel very threatened, that they feel the religion is being challenged.
Well, you really are challenging it in kind of a good way. I forget where I read it. Of course, it's not right here. But I like the part. I mean, you said that you have to get out of the 7th century and you have to look at the things that are written in the Quran and look at how they apply to today and potentially retool those for what's going on in the world now. And I thought, I would bet that's a tough sell in some crowds.
Yes. We have to teach that all theology is contextual. which we have not done. We have to have women who are scholars in leadership roles at mosques, and that's a powerful way to de-radicalize. Most of these youth were radicalized by religious people, men with beards.
Right.
And those men with beards again.
I hope Bill is now wearing a beard.
He is too. Isn't that great?
Well, you know, it's funny because I think a lot of what is in the Quran, a lot of it came from the Old Testament. Some of it was kind of converted from that, wasn't it? I mean, and that doesn't
I
a lot
really
of that
agree
doesn't
with
apply.
You. Yeah, it was some of it were hand-me-downs.
Yeah.
And there are some contradictions. And I always say, when you have a weakness, admit it up front, because then nobody can use it against you. So we have some contradictions. We have some powerful passages.
Mm-hmm.
But let's deal with the contradictions, because the extremists have gone to town with literally interpreting those contradictions.
Right.
And now it's time for us to address those.
And how do you see this going forward? Like, what's your platform? I know you do a tremendous amount of public speaking. I guess I'm thinking, how do you hit the most people for, you know, how do you make your effort really magnify itself?
Okay, so for me, this is my vision and desire and hope and dream. I am bringing together about 25 women who are experts in the topics of Sharia, blasphemy, apostasy, violence, Islamism, everything. And I'm forming the first Muslim Women's Reform Voices, a speakers bureau. And it is my hope and it is my work that will include sharing these women's voices. And we are hoping corporations, there's some resistance to bringing in religion. But we have to wake up from this slumber. You know, religion is a part of everybody's lives. We're not trying to indoctrinate, but let's have some tough conversations wherever, whenever. So my hope is to really share these resources, these women's voices, far and wide, and to reach out to women's groups. Because I, even as a speaker, Erin, I am here because many women believed my story mattered. I wouldn't be here if not that support.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when we come together and support and uplift one another, there's this 100 monkey story where there'll be a collective consciousness. Thereafter, it doesn't matter. It'll just flow. So getting to that point is the hard work.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine getting some of the maybe more, you know, some of the influential men in the Muslim, I don't know, like circles or whatever, to get those guys to help you, like Dr. Jasser, people like that. I would imagine that helps if it's not all just women.
Yes, I agree. I agree. We can't do this alone, and we shouldn't do this alone. It'll be another arduous task. Yes, they should come. I'm in contact with Dr. Jasser, and yes, we will. Then Rahil is with the reform movement in a big way. She started it with Dr. Jasser. I work with Rahil very closely. We call each other a couple of times a week. So we are consolidating our efforts.
She's a really nice lady. She's very, very easy to, you know, to speak to. Even though we've never met her in real life, you know, kind of like this. We talk on the radio.
Have you had success on the college campuses? I know there's always a lot of kickback there, but
yeah, they pretend to be real open-minded, but we all know.
Yeah, the whole freedom of speech thing on college campuses is a little frustrating today. But have you had much ability to speak there?
Well, sadly, no. In fact, I was at Yale last year. The South Asian students invited me for an event. When I reached out to the Muslim students and I had a conversation with them, they were oblivious to the challenges.
Mm.
Everybody does not recognize that there's a need to deconstruct the received theology. Everybody takes it so personally.
Right.
And the movement rising from within the colleges have been very, almost non-existent.
Right.
And that's supposed to be where, you know, the big think tank.
Open ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where everybody gets to have their own thought. I was looking on your website and I noticed you, obviously it didn't give a you know, didn't give pictures of you every minute of every day. But you dress in a very Western, I mean, you wear pants and things like that. Is that a big deal? I mean, is that, you know, like a problem thing for a lot of women?
No, I wouldn't think so. Not at all. I have friends who dress like me. We within the United States, we do not have that as a huge issue. I don't know, but when I went to Sri Lanka, where I was born and where I was raised, I saw that as an issue. Many women had turned to wearing the covering their head and bodies with long.
Yeah, it seems like they're going backwards, I guess. I'm noticing in the last, like, maybe 10 years, it just seems like there's this really regressive, sounds like you have a furry friend too. Ours, of course, would be making sound, but we don't bring them to the radio. Not because they don't want to come. But, no, I've noticed that there seems to be more, I don't even know if it's popularity. I mean, what makes women want to go back to that being covered from head to foot?
You know, I think it is an identity crisis for some. They want to show up and say, I am a Muslim and I will continue to be one. You can't stop me. Because I know a friend who she has a sister and a mother in the same family. My friend, she gave up wearing the hijab. Then her mother continues to wear it and her sister started wearing it. Because of all the issues around identity and the challenges, she said, I'm going to wear this and show myself as a Muslim.
Do you find that a lot of the women that want to dress like that were actually brought up wearing it? Or they're,
it seems
or they're
like it's
going
like
back
becoming
to
popular,
their roots? Or, you know, what's...
I see a large number speaking out of my... Finally, I always believe firmly, truth is only what you have experienced.
Mm-hmm.
When
sure.
I was in Sri Lanka this time, I was stunned. My cousins were wearing covering and wearing this long garb. So they were not brought up. We didn't wear this in back home.
Right.
But
interesting.
There is this fight, there is this rush to claim an identity.
Yeah. Right.
And there is, of course, a lot of mosques... sponsored and run by Saudi Arabia. They have a certain kind of theology that they preach. Women should behave and
mm-hmm.
All of that. So that has a huge influence.
Sure.
Yeah, it's just a mystery. Obviously, I was born here, you know, in this country and live here. So it's hard for me to understand, but I look at the women and I'm thinking, why would you want to go backwards that... I mean, because to me, that is backwards, to where you are under somebody's thumb and you can only have your eyes sticking out. And that's, I mean, you literally
like
look,
hideous, yes.
Yeah, you look like a patio umbrella. I mean, there's jokes on the web about that, you know, the three patio umbrellas in it. And it just, I don't know. I don't understand why women wouldn't, struggle against that, I guess.
Yes, yeah. I think we are in a state of slumber. Even FGM, the female genital mutilation, 98% of women are.
Yeah, that's another mystery.
To that in Egypt, and I don't know if you have seen the beautiful documentary that was done by the Clarion Project to highlight this. And when the movie came out, there was so much backlash, particularly for Rahil and her team. So the community is in a slumber, and when people like Clarion highlight these radical practices, they are pushed away, and we are pushed away for working with Clarion. So this is a very bizarre, unhealthy cycle that we reformers are pushed into.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, for good question, why are women not owning their beauty and their power
and
hiding behind some cloth? That's a great question.
I mean, could you imagine if the federal government said, okay, all women now have to, you know, wear a covering from head to toe? Are you kidding me? That'd be like, I mean, in some places, actually, it probably wouldn't be a bad idea. I mean, I think we've overcorrected in a large way. I mean, we could use a little modesty in a lot of circles, but, trying to mandate that for people, it seems impossible to me that in this day and age, and I really don't care what country you live in, I mean, you would think that there would have to be massive social pressure, I guess, for that to,
yes.
take over. Like Iran, you look at pictures of them in the 70s, and it looked like here. And now, all of a sudden, it's like the Dark Ages again.
Yes.
And all the punishments.
This is why I don't support this. Yeah, I mean, every woman should have the freedom to wear. But when I see millions of Muslim women who are suffering because of a mandated dress code, I can't take. I have to stand with them. My heart and my duty is to stand with those women who are being oppressed. Mm-hmm. So I don't see the need to glorify anybody who's wearing it.
No, and I guess it's not so much the clothes. I don't mean to be hung up on that, but with that goes a measure of subjugation and control. And they've given up their identity because it goes with all sorts of, I mean, obviously I've never lived under it. I've just read about it, but the restrictions and the rules and the control and the lack of ability to make decisions and go to school and all these things. I'm thinking, why would you do that to yourself? And why would you do that to your kids? We have to take a really quick break. And so you have 2 minutes to think about the answer. I know there is no answer, but I guess it is one of those things. If I had to pick one thing I want to know, that's what I want to know. I don't get it. I don't understand how they make it look attractive for people to do. We'll be right back. Our guest is Soraya Deen. She is part of the Muslim Reform Movement. Alrighty, we're back with our guest, Soraya Deen. All right, Soraya, we've got like 10 minutes, and we haven't talked at all about...
Where did these 40 minutes go?
I know.
Flies.
People are like, oh, I don't know what I could talk about for an hour. I'm like, are you kidding me? Burn that in the grocery store when you run into somebody. How's it going? And then, you know, an hour goes by. I was curious about your parent education thing. Why am I not finding the words I want? Oh yeah, it says you're an author, so I'm assuming it's a book, but it could be something else. But Peace Matters: Raising Peace Conscious Children. Is it a book?
It's a book. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
I mean, authors can be online, or you can be an author of a lot of things. So okay,
yes.
And that book. So let's let you promote that a little bit. We don't want to get away without a shameless plug for a book, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, so it's because I don't know whether you're a fan of Mother Teresa. I mean, when she was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace.
I think it's against the law to be not a fan of Mother Teresa, isn't it?
Who's not?
I think that makes you a pretty bad person. No one should admit that.
She said something very profound. They asked, what is the message for the world? She said, go home and love your families. And I am a firm believer that what peacemaking begins in our homes. So I, in later years, I got certified in nonviolent parenting. And I teach these classes and I embody that as much as I can because, you know, parenting is the only job that you are called upon to perform without experience.
And you can't be,
and
well,
we
I guess you can
kind of
be fired, but not really.
Yeah. So, did you ask me what it was about, Erin?
Yes, I was just curious. I hadn't, I didn't do any research on that, and I thought, kind of an interesting idea. So, tell me this, in a nutshell, what does nonviolent parenting mean? Are we talking about just not spanking? Or are we talking about not yelling at your kids all the time? Because obviously, I would be a big fan of not yelling at your kids all the time.
I know we have to sometimes, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's moments, but...
Yeah. I think for us to really understand not being manipulative and not being transactional in our parenting, because oftentimes what happens is that we fail to realize our children are born just under 25% of their brain developed. We are sculptors. We can really transform their lives by being present for them, by listening. Empathy is a huge skill we teach. I think the world suffers today not because of a lack of resources and all of that, but because of a lack of empathy. We are all walking with this invisible sign, recognize me, respect me. And we kind of fail in doing that. With parenting, really listening to the child side of it, and it's disciplining necessary, but it's not being transactional in the way that most parenting is done today. So being mindful, it's kind of a little being a mindful parent.
Yeah, and it's so important to, as a parent, you know, you send your kid off to school every day, and you hope you know what they're being taught in the classroom, but I think a lot of times they neglect to realize what they're being taught by their friends and peers.
The real education that goes on at school.
Exactly, and then when they come home, I think that's where the parent has to step in and really talk about, you know, their experiences outside the home.
Well, yes. And good or bad, I mean, I think most of us spend our adulthood going, oh, wow, I sounded just like my mom, or I just sounded just like my dad. And and as a kid, you don't really realize how much influence they have. But boy, when you grow up and you become them, truly, I told my mom that the other day. I said, you know, every problem that I solve, I think, I do in the back of my mind, I think, what'd my mom say? Because she was really good at that. She was very good at that.
That's awesome. Yeah, we try to understand anger. I get my participants to write two columns. You know, in the one side you write, how did you experience anger growing up? How was anger expressed? And then you take them to the next column and say, how do you express it? And there's such strong similarities. So much of how we parent is learned.
Oh, yeah.
And again, in nonviolent parenting, at the heart of it is, you know, not judging. Because labeling and judging and blaming is
See, our family's really good at that. Usually, it usually involves mocking, though. I mean, it's kind of a cultural problem, I think, that we have.
I know. So simply put, let's say you walk into a room, somebody has eaten your pizza. Without saying, hey, you're greedy, you learn to say, you ate the last slice of my pizza. So that's a huge shift when we communicate like that. Because in the earlier instance, you are blaming and shaming and judging. Maybe he was not greedy. He didn't know you had not eaten the pizza. Maybe he thought it was for him. So these are the mistakes that we make on a daily basis. And I always say that I'm not arrived. I'm still journeying. But just that I'm mindful when I have to apply my brakes.
Sure. Well, you know, and it's interesting because that... that's like the small version of what you're doing with your religion. You know, trying to make good communication, trying to keep things sensible and on an even level. And that's interesting what you're trying to bring to this idea of radical Islam, and bring it back down to the communication level so that people can actually learn a different way to participate. Funny.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think Muslim children have a whole other set of problems to deal with in our society. And I think Muslim parents have a little bit tougher job ahead of them when you talk about raising nonviolence. It's that's a tall order.
Yeah, especially when there's this big push to draw them in. How big is that anyway? I mean, do you have parents who say to you, gosh, I caught my kid watching, you know, scary videos of, you know, the extreme stuff?
I think the issue mostly, I mean, they did a study in London after several of those violent terror activities. What they found was most of these children who turned to terrorism, they didn't feel they belonged. The parents were uprooted, then the children, they're between cultures, and the parents are trying to say, be this person versus be this. Mm. And there was a lot of confusion for them.
Kind of like why they joined gangs of any kind.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. And I recognize some of that because I'm a first-generation immigrant, and I bring a lot of Eastern values. And then my kids are so Americanized. I struggle, you know, between which, how to really make them understand some cultural values that I hold very dear, like respect for when there's an elder who walks in, you know. We grew up standing up and greeting. But my kids, they are like oblivious to all of that.
Right, right, the handshaking and all the, all these other pleasantries, like saying
that's,
hello.
That's just not your kids. I think that's our culture as
a whole. In general.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, when you...
Yeah, so finally we all have the same issues, you know?
Yeah,
well,
at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think so.
We are intertwined and interconnected, yes.
Well, I'm glad that you've taken up this work. You seem very, very well suited for it.
Thank you, Erin.
You really do. And Raheel is a wonderful person, I'm sure, to work with. She's... it's funny. I'm sure she gets mad, but she seems like one of those people who really never gets mad.
She doesn't.
Yeah, she's like, you know, in the big the big meltdown and the crisis, and she's like, okay, everybody, let's not get upset.
She does.
Yeah, she'd be fun to work with.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a quick hour. We could go another hour, I'm sure.
Yeah, talk to Stephen or find us online. You can go to our webpage at wethepeopleradio.us and you can pull the archive of this show. The MP3 file will be up this afternoon, commercial free for you, and you can use it for whatever you want if it's of any help to you.
Oh, fantastic. And you know, Erin and Bill, I live in Los Angeles. It's a 6-hour ride for me.
You're not that far.
Yeah, so, I mean, if your listeners are there, if there are churches and synagogues, we would love to come and speak and share our message.
Okay.
And also to remember the work of Clarion that are supporting the Reform Voices. It's very important to know that we have partners and allies who support us. And we need more people to support us.
Outstanding. Well, if you're coming to Northern California, please get a hold of us.
Thank you, Erin.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Have an awesome rest of the day. That was our guest, Soraya Dean. You can find all of her information at sorayadean.com or wethepeopleradio.us. See you next week.